I would like to introduce Dr. Will Tuttle. He is an educator, composer, pianist, and writer, author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health, an animal rights and peace activist and writer for 20 years, vegan for 27 years, recipient of the Peace Abbey's Courage and Conscience Award, on board of advisors of Earth Save International, and writes bi-monthly column Food for Thought for Veg News Magazine. He has presented concerts, lectures, and seminars throughout North America and Europe. He has a PhD in education from UC Berkeley, focusing on education, intuition, and altruism. Has taught college courses in philosophy, humanities, mythology, and comparative religion. He is a Zen priest and Dharma master in the Korean Zen tradition. And he is currently conducting a music, art, and education ministry with his wife, Madeline, a visionary artist from Switzerland. Without further ado, I introduce to you Dr. Will Tuttle.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'd like to thank all the people of the, what's it called, Mars? Is that right?
Yeah, Mars.
Let's give all these folks a big hand. They worked really hard to put this on. I know it's a lot of work. Thank you. Thank you so much, really. It means a lot. I know you don't do it just for yourself. It's really a selfless action to help raise consciousness for the benefit not only of animals who really do are suffering egregiously, but also, I think, for humans and future generations and the whole Earth. So it's this kind of, I think, grassroots work that is where the energy really builds to help transform our society in a positive way. So thank you all for joining us. I know you're very busy and have lots of things you could be doing, so I really appreciate you being here to listen and also, you know, talk about our treatment of animals for food and the repercussions of that. Basically, what I'd like to do is talk about the main ideas in the book, which we just heard about, called The World Peace Diet, which I wrote recently. And what it's basically about, really, is the hidden mentality in our culture that has to do with our treatment of animals routinely for food, the routine mistreatment of animals, and how that affects not only them. They go through really horrific suffering, but really how it affects us as well, and what it does to us as a culture to have this behind this curtain that, you know, no one's supposed to look behind the curtain of what we do to animals for food, how that affects us, how that really makes it impossible for us to effectively and intelligently deal with the problems that we're creating, environmental problems, social problems, problems with equality. The whole range of human problems, I believe, in many ways, is generated by this hidden mentality of violence, massive violence, towards animals for food. How many people here think that you have a pretty good understanding of what animals typically endure to become food in our culture? Not that many, actually. All right, so I won't be going into it. I don't have like really gruesome videos to show you, but I certainly could. I've seen them all myself. It's worse than you can imagine. But what I'd really like to do is just share some of the main ideas, and then we'll take a short break, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit more and answer questions. So the basic idea, like I just said, is that we're all born into a culture that has a hidden mentality that no one talks about, and it's really a taboo to even bring this up. So I'm just thankful they're letting me say this here in, in America today. But you won't hear it on Oprah Winfrey or anywhere else. Although I heard actually that they've been talking about my book of all places on the Howard Stern show. I guess the woman there, I've never heard it, but Robin, she read my book and went vegan, and now they're all talking about it on the Howard Stern show. So maybe Oprah's next, you know. But the basic thing, though, I think really it's in a very important book, actually, because it's the first book to take this routine cruelty to animals for food, which we just don't want to talk about, and put it right in the middle of the situation here on this, in our culture anyway, and give it the attention that I think it really does deserve. The basic idea is that we're born into a culture that has this hidden core, this hidden mentality, which has some characteristics. Number one, it's a mentality of commodification, of reduction, of reducing beings to things. That's the basic thing. We reduce beings to things. When we reduce beings to things, it's a very short step from that. I mean, it's actually necessary then to cruelty to those things, because they're just things. You just use them. You throw them away. You stab them, kill them, rape them. It doesn't matter. They're things. You know, black people 150 years ago were reduced to things. So it's that mentality of reductionism. It's a mentality of commodification, turn beings into commodities that we use. It's also a mentality inherent within that of privilege, you know, because we're, you know, there's a whole hierarchy of privilege that comes out of this mentality of elitism, of predation. We're taught basically that we're predatory by nature because we're forced as children, really, in this culture to eat like predators, to eat the flesh of animals that are attacked and stabbed and killed, and so then we eat them. So it's deeply ingrained into us that we're predatory by nature. And if you just look, you know, it's a very interesting exercise. Go to the baby food section of any grocery store and see what's in those little jars. You know, we lose our mother's breast if we're ever lucky enough to even get it. But then we get these little jars that have veal, chicken, turkey, beef, macaroni and cheese. And so we imprint on that in a very deep level, right very early on, that we're essentially predatory, that we're meat eaters and so forth. And so it's a mentality of exclusion. We're taught to exclude certain beings from the sphere of our compassion. We include certain ones, we exclude other ones. We routinely exclude them. And it's a mentality also it comes from that, really, of domination and oppression and of disconnectedness, We learn to disconnect. We learn this very strongly, to disconnect the reality that's on our plate, you know, as kids growing up, from the reality that it took to get it on our plate. We're not told what it really is, right? They don't say, oh, you know, we're having the flesh of a slaughtered pig this morning, you know, everybody enjoy, you know, it's bacon, you know. We don't know what that is. I didn't know what liver, veal, you know, I didn't know what kidneys were. I mean, I was just told I had to eat it, you know. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about my own journey, just briefly, of how it came that I, of all people, would write this book, and then maybe go into some of the main ideas, and then we can take a short break. But I was born into a, I would say, very typical family, especially in terms of our eating habits. We ate the usual gigantic amounts of flesh and milk and dairy products and eggs and so forth. And I never questioned it. I had no frame of reference. This was back in the 1950s in Concord, Massachusetts, and I grew up, you know, eating it. But I do remember, actually, at one point, I think I was about 7 years old, I said to my mother, well, does everyone eat like this? And she said, yep, that's how everybody eats. And then she said, well, I guess there are vegetarians. And she said it like they're, you know, past Pluto. There's this planet, you know, and they're out there on this planet. You know, but we've heard of them. We've never met one. I hope we never do meet one, you know. But that was kind of the way I was brought up. And I think perhaps it was interesting, though, on some level, that I was born in Concord. I'll just say briefly, Concord, as you may know, is pretty well known for in a way, two revolutions. The first one is 1775 is where the Revolutionary War, they say, began. You know, and my father, every April 19th on Patriots Day, would dress up like a Minuteman and go down to the Old North Bridge, and we'd reenact the battle and fight against the British, and some men would dress up like redcoats, and we'd chase them back to Boston. And so I was kind of raised with this idea that revolution is good. You know, I mean, these were not revolutionary people at all, but we would celebrate the American Revolution, and I think that that's an important thing. You know, that we understand this on some level, that if a situation is not working, you know, if it's intolerable, if it's just, you know, destroying our well-being and our planet, then we can change it. We can have a revolution. And what I'm talking about is not a violent revolution, but a benevolent revolution of kindness and compassion to really change this way that we have been forced into seeing the world by being basically programmed by this culture from birth. And so that was one revolution. And about maybe almost 100 years later, in the mid-1800s, was the other big change that came through, which was called the Transcendentalist, you know, movement. I was born in Emerson Hospital, went to Thoreau School and Alcott School, and learned to swim in Walden Pond. You know, you've probably heard of all these things. And these were people, though, back then, that were really the first ones to bring teachings from Asia into this country And they were bringing with those teachings from Buddhism and Taoism and Vedanta and Hinduism and so forth, they were bringing ideas like ahimsa and the idea that of causing no suffering to other living beings. And these were kind of new ideas, even though actually in my book I realized that these are ancient ideas also in the West, that the ancient Greek tradition, Jewish traditions, other traditions of the West did have these ideas. There was a lot of commingling of traditions anyway back, 2,000 years ago, but it had been pretty much repressed in the West. And so they were bringing these ideas, and they were really trying to live these ideas, some of them. One in particular, Bronson Alcott, the father of Louisa May Alcott, actually Emerson lent him some money. He bought some land. They started a community called Fruitlands, and they were really trying to live this. So they weren't eating any animal foods. They weren't wearing any animal, any leather or wool. And they were trying to live a life of kindness and compassion and be really responsible. And they even wouldn't wear any cotton because, anyone know why they wouldn't wear cotton in 1840? You know why? I just gave it away. Because it was slave labor and they didn't want to, take out their wallets and pay for, whipping people to, get cotton. So they were walking around through the snowdrifts of Concord in January in shoes made out of linen. These were the first hardcore vegans, I think, in our culture. They didn't, obviously that word hadn't even been invented then. But I was completely oblivious to this whole tradition. I never, it didn't last very long. but anyway, when I got a little bit older, I remember when I was 12, I went away to a summer camp in Vermont affiliated with a dairy. So sometimes we would go down to this dairy. And it was like this archetypal, wonderful, organic dairy that everyone thinks, well, I drink organic milk. It must be just nectar from the gods, And this dairy, we were shown, a few weeks into the program, how to catch one of the chickens and I was shown how I could put her on this board on the ground and it had two nails and you kind of put her down, held her there and get her neck between the nails and then on your other hand you had your axe and you just chop her head off. And so we did that and I was glad I could do it in one chop, unlike a lot of the kids. And watched her as she ran around with no head, spouting blood, and then we ate the chickens. And I didn't, honestly, I have to say, I didn't really get too fazed by that because I had been, by the time I was 12 years old, thoroughly indoctrinated. I had been told that these animals were put here by God for us to use. They don't have a soul. They don't really matter. And anyway, if you don't eat them, you will die of a protein deficiency. So that was it. You couldn't question it. And so I wasn't really in a position at that point, I guess, in my own unfoldment, to question it. And about a few weeks later, we basically did the same thing, but this time instead of to a chicken, to a cow. We were told by the fellow who owned the place that this cow was not giving enough milk, so we were going to use her for meat. And it was interesting. Madeline and I went to the. Have you heard of the Heifer Project? Heifer International. It's a charity that goes around the world and gives animals to people to help them, which I think is not a good idea. But anyway, we went to their headquarters and they said outside Little Rock, Arkansas, at one point, and they told us that God put the animals here for us to use for the four M's, which are meat, milk, manure, and money. So these are, basically, this is how our culture sees things. These are animals that are here for us to use for the four M's. And so in this case, she wasn't good for milk, so we're going to use her for meat. And to make a long story short, we ended up in this, it was very educational, just to actually see it. But it was so different because a chicken is just a small thing. This is a 2,000-pound animal. They're huge, gigantic, really. You're up right next to one. And very strong. But anyway, we shot her with a gun in the head and took a few shots, and then finally she dropped. And I was really unprepared for to see this, right up close, because when that happened, she just, everything let go, and all the urine and feces came gushing forth, and she started convulsing on the floor. And then the fellow who ran the operation had this knife, and he just cut her head right off right there. And then when he did that, she had no head anymore, and the blood went in these long arcs through the air, and landed on the wooden floor. And then he wiped his brow, very matter of factly, and he just said to you, "You've got to do that because if you don't actively cut those arteries while the heart is still beating, then the meat will be disgusting. It'll be soaked with blood and no one will be able to eat it. We won't want to use it. It'll just waste the meat. So in my research later, which is back in the last, for the last 20 years, I've looked a lot into slaughterhouses. We've tried to get into them, but they don't let you in. But we've seen, you know, I've seen plenty of videos and talked to people and so forth. And that's basically the thing. So the reason that animals suffer so much in slaughterhouses, basically, whatever animal, whether it's cows, chickens, pigs, turkeys, ducks, geese, they suffer because we humans don't want our meat bloody. You know, we don't like this bloody meat. So we can't just sort of kill the animals and then somehow, you know, cut them up a little bit later and then eat them. We have to let them die by bleeding to death so that their hearts are beating and beat the blood out of the body. So that's why so often they're skinned while they're still conscious, or they're disemboweled while they're still conscious, or they're, you know, dragged through the boiling or dunked in the boiling water and scalded to death in the case of chickens and turkeys and in some cases pigs. And so they die very painful deaths very often. And we don't know that when we're eating whatever it is we're eating, how the animal maybe died. But it brings out, I think, in many ways, the worst in us and the slaughterhouse workers, too, because they're just treated as these objects to be killed somehow. If you want to know more, just read some of the books in the reference section of my book of signed affidavits by slaughterhouse workers. It's really appalling, actually, what these workers do to the animals. But anyway, there I was, 12 years old, and I saw all this, but I still was unable to deeply question it because I was totally programmed. That's it. That's what you do. The animals are put here for us. We eat them. Get over it. I was tough. No problem. And so we ate, you know, we ate that cow, and then I only went to this camp, 2 years. The second year, I went back there, and sure enough, you know, halfway through the summer, we went down again to this most beautiful summer day in Vermont, and this great organic, wonderful dairy where nothing but good happens. And there was another cow singled out, and again, she wasn't giving enough milk, so we're going to use it for meat. And this time, though, what was very interesting was that the fellow said, the owner said, you know, it really made a mess here on the floor of the barn. Let's not do it here. We're going to do it. And, you know, he had this little place picked out. It was maybe 100 yards away on this little hill. We'll just take her up there. So we said, okay. So we said, we all kind of said, like, come on, cow, let's go. We're going up here. And guess what? The cow said, no, I'm not going. And this is another thing that I learned. I think maybe I didn't really learn it, you know, like I should have. But looking back, I can see animals are not happy about being killed. You know, they are not like thinking, wow, I mean, you humans are so superior. It's an honor. I'm glad to give you my life. You just take it, you know, here's my neck. You know. They don't like to die. I mean, they, you know, just like us. I mean, how we would feel if some superior species came down and threw us into these, you know, some kind of factory farmed cage system and then they, you know, wanted to kill us. We'd be, you know, kind of, you know, fighting for our lives, basically. Well, that's what she was doing. She was fighting for her life. And so he said, well, let's put a rope around her neck. We'll just pull her up there. So we put a rope around her neck. We had 30 kids. We couldn't pull her. She was like, the harder we pulled, the more she resisted. And I tell you, she was stronger than we were. We couldn't do it. But as usual in this situation, this is how it always happens, we simply overwhelm them with superior force. And so he got a chain, put it around her neck, attached it to the back of his four-wheel drive pickup truck, and just started going. And so at that point, you know, she's going. And I was watching. We were all kind of, you know, I was riding in the back of the pickup. We kind of all just made a party out of it, just going up there, you know. And we got almost up there, and a miracle happened, which was she broke the chain. The chain snapped. She was pulling. She was resisting. I didn't realize she was resisting so strongly, but she was. She broke the chain. The truck lurched forward. Everybody fell down. And I remember getting up, looking back, and I saw this cow, and she was looking up at us. And she wasn't saying anything, but she was to me. She was speaking very loudly. She was saying, you know, don't do this. Please, please don't do this. And she had this chain, you know, hanging off her neck. And my mind was kind of like split at that point. I think my heart just, the chain broke somewhere inside me. And I just thought, no, let's not do this. You know, this is a mother, you know, you shouldn't kill her. But the thing was, it's like impossible. I mean, this is a dairy. You don't run a dairy out of kindness for animals. You run a dairy because you want to make money on the animal. That's the whole point. So So we knew we couldn't. You couldn't just feed this cow. She's going to feed us. So I don't remember what happened. I just remember that we did get her up there. We did kill her. We did eat her. I know that happened. And so I think somewhere some seed were planted. And when a few years later, I did eventually get to a Colby College in Maine where I went to school. And while I was there, I started hearing about vegetarians. I still never met one, but I was on the track of them. I read some about them, that they were, you know, really do exist in books and things. And I actually heard about a community down in Tennessee called The Farm, which was a vegetarian community. And they were mostly people from California, of course. They were from California. But they had found some land in Tennessee, and they were all hippies, and had long hair, and they were all vegetarians, and they were living there. And I read a few books about them, and I thought they were really interesting. You know, they were really trying to live a life of peace and justice and harmony, and they just said they were vegetarians. Actually, they were vegans, but nobody used that word back in 1974 or whenever it was. But do you know what the word vegan means? I'm just going to define it quickly here because I think it's important to get a definition of this word because I'll be using it a few more times. Vegan is a word that was invented by Donald Watson in 1944, I think it was. And he was the secretary of the Vegetarian Society in England, and he wanted a word that wouldn't be so long because he had to always type this word, vegetarian. So he wanted a nice short word, and he wanted it to account for motivation because the word vegetarian, you can be a vegetarian for any reason. You know, whatever. It doesn't not account for motivation. So he coined the word, and he said this. He said, "Veganism is a philosophy and way of life which seeks to exclude, as far as possible and practical, all forms of cruelty to animals for food, clothing, or any other purpose." So that's it. It's simply yearning to live a life where I don't contribute to cruelty to animals. It's nothing, I mean, does that sound radical? I mean, I guess it is in our culture, but it's really not, to me, it's not radical. To me, it's just simply how we all actually in our hearts feel. I mean, look at the amazing uproar over Michael Vick, what he did to those dogs, you know, and people, you can tell people don't like that. And we don't like when we, you know, to see a dog, you know, who's brutalized and, you know, drowned and beaten and all these horrible things. But it's done to pigs and chickens and cows and, you know, these other animals routinely by the millions every day. And no one minds. You know, that's the incredible double standard. And it's really it's the thing. So I'll talk about that. But anyway, that's the word vegan. And so at the farm, they were actually living this way. They were eating a plant-based diet. And so I heard about that. So eventually, after I graduated from college, just to make a long story very, very short here, I left home. I actually left home. With my brother, we decided we didn't want to go into business. We wanted to actually live a spiritual life. We really felt like, you know, I don't want to go into a corporation and just become a slave. Let's do something else. And my brother, to my delight, said, yeah, let's do something else. And so he was, two years younger than me. And so we decided we would go to California. We were on this kind of spiritual quest. We were doing meditation. I was getting interested in Zen and the Bible, you know, what Jesus said, all different things. And we just thought we should do that. So we started walking and hitchhiking. We got as far as Buffalo, New York after a few weeks. And when we got to Buffalo, we realized that actually we weren't actually going to California. It was really an inner journey. So at that point, we just walked south. We walked actually from Buffalo, New York, south. We walked every day. We'd walk maybe 15 to 20 miles a day. And we had no money. We had a little money. We gave it away so we wouldn't have anything. We had extra supplies. We gave all that away. So because when you're carrying it every day, pretty soon you think, I don't really need this. You know? And so we walked all the way down through upstate New York, all the way across Pennsylvania into West Virginia, all the way across West Virginia into Kentucky. And as we walked, we were meditating, and we were just basically living more and more actually a plant-based diet because it was autumn, you know, so the apples and zucchinis, and we were just kind of getting what we could wherever we could get it, kind of. And sometimes we would stay in churches, sometimes we'd stay in jails. They'd just throw us in jail, but only usually for one night, and sometimes in rescue missions. But we really never went hungry. We never had any serious problems, and it was a great experience, actually, all in all. But what I really want to, you know, emphasize here, I guess, is as we were walking south, I did start questioning more and more eating animal foods because I felt more and more like as I was doing this practice of deepening an inquiry into who I really am and who am I actually, and I started to just feel more of a connection with animals. And like I didn't want to harm them, even dogs, birds, they all, more and more I felt the world is so beautiful, really. Nature is so beautiful. These beings are so beautiful, and the earth, and I was just feeling more and more how precious life is. And I remember I at one point I had to catch some fish, and I caught some fish because we really were hungry, and this guy gave us the use of his cabin, and he had some fishing poles, and so I caught some fish. But then they didn't die easily. I put them in my pocket of my raincoat, and I thought they would die by the time I get back to the cabin. But when I get back there ready to like cut them open, they were still like flopping around, so I had to really kill them. And I thought, this isn't right. Here I am, meditating for peace and stabbing him the next minute. but I still thought, where am I going to get my protein? So we went on, and we eventually did get to the farm. We walked all the way to Tennessee, and we thought, well, let's just go there. It's a neat place. When we got to the farm, just south of Nashville, there were almost 1,000 people there, and they were basically, they were very healthy. They were living a totally vegan life. I mean, they weren't eating any animal foods. They had about almost 100 kids in the school, vegan from birth, healthy, strong, happy. They were, they had all these fields and all this, vegetables and grain and stuff they were growing. And they started talking to us and about their life. And I thought it was very interesting. And I remember the guy was showing us around, and he said, yeah, I'm wearing some vegetarian shoes. And I remember thinking, wow, they even have vegetarian shoes on top of it. I thought that's pretty. I said, Ed, look at this. They even have vegetarian shoes. So I was realizing, I was starting to get a glimpse. I mean, this is back in 1975. No one had ever heard of tofu or ever heard of anything, But they started telling us about what animals go through. And I really was somewhat aware, but they were telling us how, like on a typical egg production facility, all the chickens are crammed into these cages and their beaks are, seared off, and so they won't poke each other's eyes out, and how the pigs and other animals, the males, are castrated without anesthesia, and how the babies are always taken from their mothers, and all these horrible things. And at the same time, just letting us know, which we already, I guess, on some level knew, but we didn't really want to think of, there was all this delicious vegetarian food, vegan food, really. And so that was it. I never ate meat again in my life since then. I just made the connection, and that was it. And I think having a community like that made it so easy. It was just easy. I lived there for about a month, I think. And then we continued on eventually to a Zen center in Alabama, if you can believe that, but it's really true. There was a Zen center in Alabama. And then eventually I did get to San Francisco a couple of years later, lived in a Tibetan Buddhist center and some other meditation centers, and then eventually got to South Korea, where I shaved my head and lived as a Zen Buddhist monk. Changed my name, everything, wore robes. And it was there, at that community, that was my second time in a vegan community. But in this case, they had been vegan for 650 years. So it wasn't just kind of a new thing. It was an ancient tradition. And so while I was there, we did a lot of meditation. We'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and just go till 9 o'clock at night and just sit on the floor and in silence. So they didn't talk about why they were vegan or anything. But it just kind of got into me at a deep level. And I remember when I eventually came back to this country, I felt like I had these roots that went deep into my heart, because it was living in a community where animals simply were not things. They were sacred, sensitive beings, and you wouldn't eat them, wear them. You wouldn't even actually, believe it or not, kill a mosquito in this place. I mean, you'd take the mosquito outside and let her go. So it was really kind of radical in that way. But when I came back to this country, I thought, gosh, we are like sort of the opposite of that. And so I started. I got a PhD at Berkeley, started teaching college courses. And really doing a lot of research as much as I could on what animals go through for food, and connecting that really, I think, more and more with our cultural predicaments, what the problems we're having. And eventually I started to get this larger and larger view. I think maybe, I'm not sure why, but anyway, I started getting this larger and larger view, and I could see how everything is connected. I mean, there's the mentality underlying our meals is invisible. We force children into it. Like our parents were forced into it by their parents and their parents by their parents, and it kind of has come through the generations to just reduce these beings to things. But this reducing beings to things, it has incredible consequences, because we learn to look with eyes that reduce others, and we end up reducing ourselves. The ancient spiritual and universal teachings of all the traditions have a few things to say about this. Number one is, whatever you would most want for yourself, give to others. This is a very powerful teaching. Whatever you would most want for yourself, give to others. And so if we want to have freedom, you know, and peace for ourselves, we should, you know, let others live in freedom and peace. If we don't, we end up, we're not going to have it for ourselves. It's also basically the law of, I guess, what you'd call karma. You know, as you sow, so shall you reap. Whatever seeds we sow, we will reap. If we plant carrots, we're not going to get turnips. We're going to get carrots. You know, so we are planting seeds of incredible suffering for millions of animals every day in this country. But we are, I think, extremely naive to think that those seeds just blow away, that nothing happens. We have whole armies of our brothers and sisters that do nothing but stab animals, mutilate animals, confine animals in the most horrific ways, and for food. It's huge. I mean, it's like Niagara Falls of blood every day in this country. You can't even imagine the numbers. The numbers of animals are so vast, you know, per second. And it's something like 12 million every day. So we are killing, you know, for food. It's huge. And so we are planting those seeds, and those seeds just don't evaporate. You know, they actually manifest. And like Martin Luther King said, you know, violence against anyone, anywhere hurts everyone, everywhere. You know, because we're all connected. We have to understand the interconnection that we have. We're taught, I think, in many ways at a deep level that we're not connected, like we're all separate, and what happens to someone else doesn't affect us. But I think we know at a deep level it does affect us. So if we have whole armies of people that we are actually paying to bring the worst out in them, and if you really read what these poor people have to do and how they treat when they come home, how they treat their kids, how they treat their spouses, you know, the incredible violence that is generated out of this and how it's taken out and how it infects whole communities. And then when we eat that, we actually eat those vibrations, we eat the toxins of that, and we have this whole like hidden world that you can't even talk about. It's not publicized, it's not on the media, no one knows about it, we can't talk about it, it's a taboo really even to talk about. Then we've sown the seeds for not being able to understand why we can't solve the problems that we have. And so this, I think, is really the key. And so as I was looking into this more and more, and because I was, you know, I had gotten a PhD at UC Berkeley in education, and I'd gotten a master's degree in humanities, and so I had studied a lot of philosophy, sociology, anthropology, and you know, all these education and peace studies, environmental studies, all these different subjects. I was trying to like know everything, you know, see how everything connects, and so I started thinking, you know, someone's going to write a book that will give this big picture. I mean, it's pretty obvious. You know, people usually talk about just three things. You know, they talk about the suffering to animals, the health effects, how it's bad for our health to eat a lot of animal foods, and the environmental effects, how it's bad for the environment to feed all the grain to animals instead of eating it ourselves, how it causes so much pollution. But the bigger effects, the effects on us psychologically, the effects on us spiritually, the effects on us culturally, socially, the effects, you know, the bigger effects, the history of it, the anthropology of it. So I was telling Natalie, I remember, you know, if someone's going to write about this, it's going to be so interesting. And the years went by, nobody wrote. I kept thinking, yeah, book's going to be great. I can't wait till that book comes out. It'll be so fun to read that book. Finally, I started thinking, you know, if I want to read such a book, I'm going to have to write that book. So I ended up just working for 5 years, and I wrote the book, and Madeline helped with great meals every night, and I worked, and we were at that point, I had stopped teaching college, we were traveling, I was playing piano concerts, and I think music helps you think, maybe. I don't know, but it worked really well, and so the book came out, and basically, I'll go through just maybe the first couple of chapters, then we can take a short break, and then maybe I'll talk a little bit more about a couple other things, and then answer questions, maybe so you're not sitting for too long. But in the beginning of the book, I mainly just talk about the, you know, how we got into this situation. Because most people think, well, this is natural. I mean, having burgers at Burger King and McDonald's is just, that's how we human beings are. It's just natural. Of course, all of our ancestors ate just as much meat, and anyway, it's not true, and so we have to understand, you know, like who we really are and what the effects of our cultural programming actually have been, and then we'll begin to see that, you know, most people think that they just eat meat and dairy products because they choose to, but we've been forced into it. We've been forced into it in the most powerful ways by every single institution in our culture: religion, science, education, the family, government, law. Every institution in this culture is oriented around one thing, which is that animals are reduced to things. That's the fundamental driving core of our culture, because the food of any culture is the organizing thing. I mean, if you don't eat, you know, you have to understand that. We can say that in other cultures. We say, yeah, food, how they eat, that's important. Well, it's important for our culture. We're eating animals. We don't see it like we did maybe a couple hundred years ago. The animals now are locked up in concentration camps and huge sheds far from the roads. You don't even see them. They're just locked away for the most part. But there's this massive industry, and every day you just drive down the street, you'll see everywhere. You'll see McDonald's, Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Arby's. You know, everywhere you go, the supermarket, there's flesh and fluid secretions of animals everywhere. And we don't know where it comes from, right? We just don't know where it comes from, but it just sort of magically appears here, and we eat it because that's what humans always ate. So we don't understand the driving core of our culture is reducing beings to things, and every institution propagates that. And so this mentality that I was talking about is ritually injected into us at the deepest level by our parents through our meals. The only ritual that we repeat every day, three times a day, a sacred ritual, is eating. And it's a ritual of disconnectedness, of consciously disconnecting. And so we become, in our culture, unfortunately, we become masters of disconnectedness. We are so good. Whatever you practice, you become good at. You become an expert. And that's what we practice. We can just disconnect, boy. You know, burning down the rainforest, you know, destroying the oceans, whatever, starving people, attacking people in other countries, and we just disconnect. Just don't think about it. Don't even want to know. We just disconnect. We're great at that because we've been trained since right after we were born to disconnect from what we've been eating. So to understand the history of it is extremely interesting. I don't really think I have time to go into this. There's a chapter, chapter one is about food's power. Chapter two is about the history. Basically, I'll just say it's only been going on 8 to 10,000 years. About 8 to 10,000 years ago, it's not that long in terms of human development, people started for the first time herding animals, actually reducing them to property. They became capital. They became wealth. You know, and it happened, ironically enough, in the country that is now called Iraq, and that was where people first started 8 to 10,000 years ago, you know, owning sheep and goats, and then a couple thousand years later, it spread to became cattle. That was the last revolution our culture ever experienced, I believe. And all the other revolutions since then are not revolutions like the industrial and scientific. These revolutions, they didn't change anything. We can eat more animals than ever because of them, you know. That didn't change anything. That was a revolution because it changed everything. It really changed us. Men had to become capable of sustained violence against animals because it's hard work to control, confine, castrate, kill these large animals, especially cattle. The cattle cultures became the most brutal, vicious cultures, with men who were had to become that way. These were the role models, the tough cowboys, you know, from back then. So this goes, and this culture has continued, and it was a reduction of women to the status of property. By the time the historic era emerged, which was like 3,000 years ago, it's well in place. And I used to teach these courses in ancient mythology. You look at the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Epic of Gilgamesh, the Sumerian tradition, the first earliest books of the Old Testament, you'll see, just read. It's obvious. It's well established. You have this wealthy elite of the kings. They own what? They own capital. Capital comes from Latin, means head. Capital is animals. Animals are wealth. So these animals have been reduced to things, and you have the whole rest of the society is basically cannon fodder, sword fodder for these kings as they try to get more wealth and steal others' cows and goats and sheep and the land and water for them. The first slavery, massive slavery, emerges on the planet, because once you enslave animals, it's a very short step to enslaving humans. Once you reduce animals, it's a very short step to reducing humans. So women are reduced. People from other tribes are become enslaved. The males are castrated, become slaves. The females become concubines or become, you know, just property. And the animals are reduced. And all the predatory animals, I mean the so-called predatory, all the wild animals are also reduced to being pests. You know they might hurt my cows, so we just trying to kill them off. So, and nature is reduced. So this whole reduction of nature, of animals, of people, came from reducing animals. And this is the mentality that allowed the big wars to occur. And the very first word for war, actually, it's so interesting, is gavya. Gavya is the old Sanskrit word that means desire for more cows. So this, the very first wars were, and it's been continuing basically for property, for more capital. So this, we have been born into this culture because it spread throughout the whole Mediterranean. It spread into Europe. It spread to this country. They brought the same thing when they came over here, and it's still going. So if we want to really transform our culture, I think, to a culture where we actually have a chance of peace and harmony and justice and environmental sustainability, we have to look at the obsolete underlying assumptions of reducing beings to things, of reducing nature to things, of reducing women to things, of reducing others to things, and we ultimately end up reducing ourselves to things. You know, we reduce ourselves into this object. We try to make a good resume for ourselves, you know, sell ourselves on the market so we can get what we want. We become a commodity ourselves. Everything becomes commodified. And the whole idea is then in this culture is that you'll be happy if you buy the right commodities. It's a total consumerist orientation. You consume animals, you consume the world, consume, consume, consume. Happiness comes from consuming because we've warped our consumption. We've disconnected from the animals. We don't see them as beings. We don't see them as sacred. We don't care for them. And so we've numb ourselves as a culture. We're forced into this numbing process, and we end up creating a situation of gross inequality and an unimaginative approach to life where our efforts at peace, I think, ultimately will be seen to be merely ironic. You know, like we want peace while we have this whole, you know, other arm stabbing animals over and over again. You know, we want harmony and we're just, you know, castrating and confining them. We want to have nice, healthy families while we're stealing the babies away from those mothers that, and they're crying. How can that ever happen? We say, well, they don't matter. They're just animals. But their happiness to them matters as much to them as my happiness does to me. We've always said that about people we want to harm. We say they're just something. They have a central nervous system just like ours, with pain receptors just like us. They feel pain just like we do. They bleed just like we do. They hurt. You know, you step on a dog's tail, he doesn't go, I don't feel that. You know, he goes, ow! You know, get off my tail, you know. They feel pain. They feel social pain. They feel emotional pain. They hurt. You know, if you confine them in a little box, they go crazy. I mean, the pigs in the factory farms are driven insane. They are in these narrow, where they can't, you know, are immobilized in metal bars, and they do nothing. In many cases, you go in there, and they're just banging their heads on the metal bars all day. They're nuts. They're crazy. Their babies are stolen. They're impregnated. Their babies are stolen. They can't move. What would you do? You do the same thing. Pretty soon you'd be banging your head against the wall. You know, that's, and then we eat that. And we say, well, that's the other white meat, or whatever they say. You know, it's, we have been completely fooled about the nature of reality, actually, in this culture. And it comes about through our eating. So I'll just close maybe with one more point in the beginning of this of the book, which is about intelligence. Intelligence is the ability to make connections. Intelligence is the ability in any system to make connections that are meaningful for that system. So, you know, a human being has intelligence, a cow has intelligence, a dog has intelligence, a culture has intelligence. Intelligence is the ability to make connections that are meaningful for us. And as we do that, we can flourish and grow, and we can serve the larger wholes that we're part of. So what this whole way of eating has done is it has forced us to disconnect and to not really know what we're doing. And since we disconnect at the deepest level from our meals, we end up disconnecting from a lot of other things. And I think what we have to do is look at how this plays out. Look at the problems that we have. The problems that we read about in the newspapers, that we look at on the television, or we hear about on the radio, are problems that, in every case, we are inflicting on animals. Remember what I said earlier, what I discovered was whatever we do to others comes back to us. I call it the boomerang effect. And you put something out, it comes back. So look at these problems. I mean, you read about the obesity epidemic. And we have this obesity epidemic. Everybody's getting fat. You know, oh, man. And it's true. I mean, it's incredible to look. In the last 30 years, the percentage of people overweight and obese has done nothing but go like this. I mean, it's just skyrocketing. And so people go, well, how can we solve this problem? What are we doing to animals? We're making them fat. These animals are sold by the pound. We give them special feed, high, just like we, you know, high fat, high cholesterol feed, and we give them special drugs, special hormones to make them get as fat as possible, as quickly as possible. So these animals, if you look at them, I mean, you go to, you know, these pigs, chickens, cows, turkeys, they're all forced into obesity. And so we sow those seeds in them, and we reap the same thing in our, so we reap obesity for ourselves. Or osteoporosis is another thing, very ironic, because osteoporosis is when calcium gets leached out of the bones, and especially in older women, and their bones are breaking all the time. They have no, they have weak bones. And this is another epidemic. What are we doing to animals? Osteoporosis. We're forcing osteoporosis onto these animals, especially onto the female animals. So it's, of course, it's females that happens here. It's especially dairy cows and hens on leg, on egg laying operations. They force these animals to give much more milk and much more eggs than they ever would naturally by giving them, again, special feed and special hormones to just boost their, you know, it's like way, like a cow normally would give at the most 20 pounds of milk a day. They're given like 110 or 120 pounds of milk a day. So that, what that does is that that leaches the calcium out of the bones of the cow into, and goes into the milk. The dairy industry, you know, they, I mean, it's ridiculous. They say, drink your milk, you know, you'll get all this calcium. Well, for one thing, the calcium is not bioavailable because it doesn't have magnesium. The other thing is you're stealing it from the cows, and the cows get osteoporosis because it's all this, they're being pushed to overproduce. And so these animals end up being downers. Do you know what downers are? Downers are animals that can no longer walk when they get to the slaughterhouse. It's really horrible. I mean, you see some videos of downers. Downers, you know, when they try to take them off the truck, their bones have broken. These are dairy cows because they've been forced to give so much milk. Calcium's been taken out of their system. And after only 4 years, they're typically only 4 years old when they're killed, and these are animals that would live 25, 30 years in the wild. And when they go to take them to the slaughterhouse, they can't walk. Their bones would just break, so they drag them horribly. And same thing with chickens. Their bones just break because they're forced to give so many eggs, and the calcium in the eggshells, you know, just leaches it all out of their bones. So we sow the seeds of osteoporosis in them. We reap it ourselves. Everything else you can think of, the breakdown of the family, which is a big concern. There's no families on factory farms. The males are always separated from the females, the mothers, the families. I mean, animals are primarily intensely social creatures. They have, you know, especially the animals that we eat, they, you know, chickens, turkeys, and cows and pigs. And they're social creatures. We break apart their families. We take away the babies from the mothers. And so we tear apart their family. We sow those seeds, and we reap that in ourselves, the breakdown of the family. Or drug addiction is another one we hear a lot about. These animals are drugged massive quantities. They don't escape it. They're always being injected with something. There's over 30,000 different drugs that are administered, not by veterinarians, just by workers, you know, they stab. This guy says, "I just keep putting that needle until it breaks." And so these animals are drugged, and they're given hormones, they're given antibiotics. You know, there's more antibiotics given to animals than there are people today. And so all these different problems, whatever we have, the environmental devastation. We find ourselves having to live in increasingly polluted environments. We force animals into incredibly polluted environments. We make them live in, well, you can't even breathe, and the ammonia and the stench and eating this really toxic food, and we find our food is getting more toxic. We're doing to them everything that we don't want to have happen to us, but we're doing it to them. And, you know, anything you can think of, war and terrorism, rape, I mean, all these problems that we're having, we're doing to them. We are terrorists and rapists to these animals. There's no way around it. I mean, they're put into conditions of chronic and acute fear and pain and terror by the system that we have created. So we are sowing these seeds, and we are reaping the results of that, and yet we cannot see it. And it's amazing to me, honestly, when I think about this, that I was able to go through an entire, you know, whole cycle of education at UC, ending up with my PhD at UC Berkeley, which was the number one ranked graduate school of education in North America when I was there, and read literally, you know, hundreds of books, probably thousands, and in all these different areas, and never read one sentence even that said, maybe the reason we're having the problems we're having, maybe the reason we have the difficulty we're having solving our problems is the mentality of violence towards animals for food. It's an unthinkable thought. You couldn't even ever think that. You couldn't even articulate it. No one could even say it. You know, this is such an obvious thing. It's so obvious. I mean, if anyone came from outer space and came to our culture, it would be the most obvious thing. Like, well, you've got these people, and they just have, you know, literally billions of animals enslaved. They're slaughtering. There's blood. There's killing, everything. And we are totally, the next chapter goes into, it's called the intelligence of human physiology. We are not carnivorous. I mean, we do not have the dentition. We don't have the saliva. You know, our saliva has one enzyme in it, which is designed to break down carbohydrates. There's no carbohydrates in animal flesh or dairy products or eggs. I mean, our whole circulatory system, digestive system, everything about us can't deal with animal flesh, or especially with cow's milk. My God, it's like the worst poison you could put in yourself, really, if you look at it strictly from a point of view of physiology. It's the most obvious thing, and it's the thing, because I think we feel at some level a very acute kind of painful sense of grief about what we're doing to these animals, so we just don't talk about it. We just ignore it. We just numb ourselves to it. And because of that, it's like you've heard of that saying, the elephant in the living room, you know, no one can talk about. This has become it. It's called, really, I think, have you heard of Carl Jung, the psychologist Carl Jung? He talked about the shadow archetype. This is the big shadow, the thing that what the self is, but does not admit to being, so projects onto others. So those are some of the main ideas in the first part of the book, and some of the background of how I wrote the book. What I thought we could do is maybe take just a short break, and I'm happy if you want to find out more from me about the book, or I can sign one for you if you want to get one. I think it's one of the most eye-opening books. The guy that coined the word vegan, I'll just say this in closing, Donald Watson, he recently passed away at the age of 95, and my friend Joe Connolly, who is the editor of Veg News magazine, was visiting him. You know, he went over to England, and he went over there actually three times, and he found this guy, he's a very interesting guy to interview, and he was still very healthy. He was like hiking in the mountains of, well, not really mountains, the hills of England, at the age of 95 and very healthy and everything. The third time he went over, he was going to interview him in hopes of making a small book about his life, and when he got there, after a few days, he called me on the phone, and he said, "Will, I just got to tell you this. Donald Watson, he is in bed, and he's told me that he feels like it's time for him to leave the planet. He's going on. He feels like he did his work here. But I thought you'd be interested to know, because my book had just come out, he had gotten a copy of it. And he said, all he does every afternoon is he just has his son-in-law read to him from your book. And he said, and he says to me, this is exactly what I was trying to say. Now I can go. So I was really like, oh my gosh, it's like all on me. But I think he's the guy that coined the word vegan. But I think really, the if you understand what veganism really is, it's just having eyes. It's nothing to be proud of. It's just having eyes. When we look out of our eyes, we see beings. We don't see things. We see beings. And our natural sense of kindness and compassion and respect for beings then is functioning. And our life does nothing but get better and better. Believe me, it's just the best thing. But it's also difficult because our whole culture is just the opposite. You know, it's like, you know, they think it's the bad thing to do. But it's been the greatest, best decision I ever made in my life, for sure. So I'm happy to talk to you, maybe have a few minutes, stretch a little bit. I know you've been sitting there, you know, not doing anything for a little while. And then we can come back maybe in like 5 or 10 minutes. And I'm happy to take questions. And maybe talk a little bit more about some of the other ideas in the book in the second part. Let's take a short break. Thanks. I wanted to talk a little bit more about maybe a few of the ideas and then take questions if you have questions. There's really a lot in the book. There's more than we can talk about in the time we have here. But I'll just say brief. I'll go through maybe just a few of the other chapters. And maybe if you have specific questions about some of this, we can go into it a little more in depth. There's a chapter, like I said, called "The Intelligence of Human Physiology," which basically goes into in more depth our human physiology and where we designed for eating animal foods. And I think that's very important to understand more clearly because we're given these ideas that we're designed for that. So this book really goes into that and how the basic idea, I guess, is that There's no nutrient that we need as human beings that we cannot get from plant-based sources. And so, people typically who eat a plant-based diet live longer and healthier and all that. So the book isn't so much about the health aspects of vegetarianism, but I do have a chapter on there just to help people understand that, because that's the main reason people give for eating meat is, well, you've got to have, and then they say some kind of thing you've got to have that you can only get, they say, in animals. And it's not true. And but also just to look at our psychology, our physiology, and see that we're not equipped really to eat animal foods. In fact, it's disgusting to us. I mean, we have to disguise the foods quite a bit. And the other thing is just to understand the massive scale of the medical establishment, medical pharmaceutical establishment. I mean, it's big, I think it's one of the probably the largest institutions in our culture in terms of just sheer investment of literally trillions of dollars in hospitals and in training programs and research institutions. And as Madeline and I travel around the United States, we actually have been living in an RV for 12 years, traveling and giving lectures and concerts around North America. We see this. You know, we just see they're sprouting up everywhere like mushrooms. And so in order for the bankers to get to get their investment back in building all these things, you've got to have really I hate to say it, but you got to have a massive an unreliable population of very sick people, you know, to keep this whole thing running. And you're only going to get that basically by feeding them the kinds of foods, high fat, high cholesterol foods that come from the bodies of animals that have been fed a lot of toxins and a lot of hormones and so forth. And so if you want to take responsibility for your own health or for the health of the environment, this is something to understand at a deeper level, our whole anatomy and how it works. Anyway, I have a chapter on that. There's a chapter called Hunting and Herding Sea Life, which I think is very important and interesting. You know, what we do to the animals we call fish, and fish, are, I think, of all the animals, they are really like, oh, you don't even care less about their feelings, right? I mean, just the fish. But I think, recent research, for one thing, has shown that fish are remarkably intelligent. They have intelligence, according to researchers who are actually researching their intelligence, about equivalent to primates, to monkeys. They have very complex social relationships. They have long-term memories. They definitely feel pain most, very acutely, like right here where you hook them. Because they would be like us, feel the same way. And they remember, like if they get shocked in a tank somewhere, they won't go back there. They know that, So they are much more sophisticated. And there's so much to say about this, but I'll just briefly, there's more fish now in the United States that are being eaten that are come from factory farms than are caught wild, because basically the bodies of water, the oceans and lakes and streams, are being depleted, especially the oceans of fish. So it's very hard to go out there and get fish anymore. So they're being raised, and I've seen these places. I mean, I've looked into, and you don't even know what it is. I remember looking into this huge concrete like swimming pool kind of thing, and the water is totally black. I remember looking in there and going, oh, it's just black water, nothing in there. And then I realized it was utterly packed with fish. I mean, they were just swimming, and they were swimming in their own feces. That's why the water was black. And then the workers were dumping antibiotics in on top of it just to try to keep the fish alive long enough that they could be eviscerated and shocked and killed. And that's the stuff people eat so they can get their, heart-healthy omega-3s or whatever they think they're getting. And it's very toxic, and it's cruel, and it's horrible. And it uses so much resources to feed these fish that we could feed hungry people. The driving force, as you know, behind starvation is the waste of grain on animals when we could easily feed many more people than are living on the planet right now if we fed them directly. So understanding what we're doing not only to the factory farm fish but really to the oceans, the whole ocean ecosystem is being devastated by longline fishing, by bottom trawling, these operations. They have these huge nets now that are so heavy, so big, and they just trawl them along the bottom of the ocean floor with these huge wheels, they're the size of like six school buses, and they go and they just crush everything and they take everything up, and about half of what comes up is called bycatch, turtles, cetaceans, dolphins, whales, and especially birds and other, and just fish that they can't use, and it gets thrown back and basically dead. And so these are devastating operations that are going on because people want to eat fish. And not only that, but huge amounts of fish roughly 40 to 50% of the fish that is brought in is not fed to people, it's fed to animals. So in fact, it's comical to think of cows, you know, going into a stream and like fishing, you know, trying to catch fish like bears do. But actually, dairy cows have become the number one predators of fish in North America. They feed more fish to cows than they do anyone else, because it takes huge amounts of called enriched feed, which is enriched mainly with fish, to push the cows to give more milk. So you're actually, when you're buying milk, you're buying fish. Anyway, so there's a chapter on that. There's a chapter called The Domination of the Feminine. Don't get me started on that. That's really important. But I'll just say this briefly. It's the female animals that are most severely abused and brutalized in this whole system. It's the female pigs, especially the female cows and chickens, because they're the ones that give birth. So it's their reproductive organs, especially, that scientists have been working on for thousands of years. I mean, the first science really was how to get the cows and sheep and goats to give, you know, have more babies and give and raise, you know, livestock that had more fat on it, or had more wool on it, or had, you know, was better acclimated to the environment. So they've been working a long time, and it's mainly the females that they've been messing with. And I think we know, all of us in our hearts, when we feel into, feel into ourselves and feel into life, that there is something deeply sacred about a mother giving birth to a baby and nurturing that baby with her milk, and having a safe place to raise her baby, and what we do on these factory farms, and especially what we do on dairy operations and egg production operations, is the most cruel and horrific abuse of that. And I think in order for us to do that to them, we have to kill out of ourself the feminine dimension of ourself. This is why our culture is in such danger. We systematically have killed out of ourselves, especially the children growing up, the feminine dimension, especially in boys. You know, we're taught as boys to be hard and tough and disconnected from our feelings, disconnected from this feminine quality of gentleness and tenderness and kindness. And women too, and because we're doing it on a massive scale to these animals, and then eating the products of that, and feeding it to our kids, and so it's this whole repression of what I call in the book Sophia. Sophia is the Greek goddess of wisdom. There's this understanding that we have a certain wisdom that's a feminine in nature, and as a culture we're very patriarchal, very masculine oriented. It's like the feminine wisdom is repressed, and the feminine sacred functions of giving birth and nurturing the birth and lactating and all that, these functions have been constantly brutalized and suppressed. And it's ongoing all the time. And so that whole energy radiates into our culture and as practices and as a mentality, and it just devastates this feminine dimension of ourselves. And I think this is what we have to really regain. This is the intelligence that will help us to live in peace and kindness and sustainability on this planet. So that chapter goes into that in more in depth. There's a chapter called The Metaphysics of Food, which goes into the toxins that are not just physical toxins in food, but also we're eating of grief and despair and terror and panic and fear, and all that level of things is important, I think, to understand. So that chapter goes into that, and there's a chapter called Reductionist Science and Religion, which goes into science and religion, which actually is one of my favorite chapters. I can answer questions about that maybe afterwards, because I know we want to answer some questions. There's a chapter called The Dilemma of Work, which really goes into work and how we don't like to work, really. It's like, especially how men are affected by this. This whole system is very damaging to females. It's also very damaging to males, to the men in our culture. And so it goes into in boys and how how boys are basically brutalized by the culture in their feelings, and they're taught to be cruel. There's a chapter 11 is Profiting from Destruction, which goes into the whole environmental effects of eating animal foods. And again, basically, when as Madeline and I travel around the United States, we see this with our own eyes. It's heartbreaking to see what we're doing to the land in North America. It's getting worse and worse. I mean, the water's getting more and more polluted. There's more algae blooms. It's getting greener. It's just everywhere you look, the land is either growing soybeans or corn, some kind of grain for animal feed, or it's being devastated as grazing land in the western United States especially. You can really see it. and the rivers are being, the Colorado River doesn't even reach the ocean anymore. It's being used for irrigation, and they irrigate grain, and then they have these huge, ugly factory feedlots where they feed all these animals. I mean, it's so ugly. And people eat this stuff and end up, you know, with heart disease and cancer and diabetes and kidney stones and every arthritis, all these problems that comes directly from that. And so we're devastating the earth. The whole driving force behind the devastation of the rainforest in South America and the forest in this country really is growing grain to feed animals. It's just wasting. It's monocropping too, which is devastating to the environment. Anyway, so this goes into that, the use of the pollution of water, the sewage, the massive amount of sewage that's released, the use of petroleum, the waste of petroleum and natural gas for fertilizer. We have to understand all these things. You have to understand what is going on. You won't find this in the media. This is the amazing thing, like Al Gore with his global warming. I mean, never mentions that the number one driving force, according to even the conservative United Nations report, more important than driving cars is eating meat. You know, and that's not, he doesn't say to eat less meat, and you know, that's not even on the list of 10 or 20 or 30 things to do. I mean, it's just another, but another of countless examples of how our culture can't bear the thought of looking behind the curtain of our abuse of animals, our routine abuse of animals, and how it's causing the most severe problems that we have. There's a chapter called Some Objections Answered, which goes into, I like this one because this book is especially made for not only for people who are vegans or wanting to know more about it, but as a book to give to someone who they want to know why you're a vegetarian or why you're a vegan. You say, here, read this. Because it goes into the deep, not only the surface reasons, but the deeper reasons. And so in here, this chapter is the objections that people naturally have. You know, like, well, I don't think what you're saying makes any sense because, you know, Jesus ate meat and so it must be okay. You know, or the Bible says you got to eat meat to be, whatever. Or the Indians ate meat and they were spiritual, so it must be okay. Or plants, they have feelings. You know, I know if you eat a chicken or eat a carrot, it's all the same thing, so it must be okay. You know, whatever different, So anyway, I have a whole chapter that addresses all the objections that people have. And then the last couple of chapters are on going more deeply into the situation and mainly how it's a very positive situation. I mean, I know in some sense you think, gosh, positive, it doesn't sound very positive. But it is positive because this is something anyone can change. I mean, we can change this. We can change the way we're eating, and we can encourage others to do the same thing, and we can change our mentality. We're not inherently, warlike or inherently incapable of living in harmony on this earth. It's rooted, I believe, in this chronic, should be over here, maybe, mistreatment of animals for food. And once we begin to understand this, we can begin to be a voice not only for the animals who are brutalized, but really for us, for our children, because it hurts us. Whatever we do to them hurts us just as much. As an ancient spiritual teaching, it says this. It says, when you harm someone else, you harm yourself more than you harm them. You get that? I mean, that's important to understand. When we harm others, we harm ourselves more. Ultimately, that's true. And another teaching is, whatever you ignore most forcefully will control you the most. And in our culture, we just ignore this so forcefully. It's like, don't talk about this. Anyone who's a vegan knows when you try to talk about it, people go, well, let's change the subject really fast here. Let's talk about something else. These are things that, in a sense, are very hard to talk about because people feel so much deep level seated guilt. But on the other hand, it's something that we can really make a transformation. And as we do that, we can easily transform this planet. I mean, I think, when one person makes a change, our life changes a lot. But just imagine our culture as a vegan culture, right? It's a whole different culture. It's totally different. And that is possible. It's totally within the capacity of us as human beings to do that. That would be the great benevolent revolution that I think we're yearning for, we're longing for at a deep level. And people say it's impossible. There's no reason for it to be impossible. I mean, it's just simply a matter of education, of talking about it, of understanding. And once we understand, it's easy to change, actually. And so I would be happy to take questions from people if you have any questions about this. Maybe the last thing I'll say and then before the questions is simply that it looks like on the surface that being a vegan is like saying no, I'm not going to I'm not going to buy your cruelty things. I'm not going to take out my wallet. I'm not going to pay someone to stab animals. You know, it looks like it comes from no, right? But actually, it comes, and it's true. On one level, it is a refusal to participate in the, you know, in the group stabbing melee that's going on against poor animals. And really, what we see is that our violence towards animals. You know, the animals cannot retaliate. That's the thing. The animals, see, like, we're nice usually to other people or beings, if they are beings, who can retaliate. You know, if we hurt them and they're going to sue us or they're going to hit us back, then we say, well, be nice to you. You know, we'll just leave you alone. Okay. But if there's a being who cannot retaliate, you know, and in any way, and then we just, you know, we harm them and they just take it, that really shows the level of our ethical awareness. And animals cannot retaliate, so we just use them. We use them for their skin, entertainment, research, flesh, babies, whatever. We just use them. So they cannot retaliate, but our violence itself retaliates against us. It does retaliate. We don't get away with it. Our violence retaliates, and it retaliates in all these ways. So what veganism is simply having eyes. When we look out of our eyes, we see beings. It's not, like I said earlier, it's nothing to be proud of. It's simply this capacity, for some reason, something, it's like a breakthrough that happens. I think it really takes a breakthrough to somehow move through the incredible, not only the initial conditioning we all got from our parents and from our school and from our doctors and, you know, and from the TV, but it's ongoing. It's ongoing conditioning. You walk out of this room, I guarantee you, walk out of here, you go into this society, we are just all bombarded that animals are things to be eaten. So to question that, it takes a breakthrough. And I think it's the most positive, most powerful, most loving thing you can do. And so like I was saying, it looks like it's a big no. I'm not going to participate in this. But actually, that no is founded on a big yes. You know, it's really founded on saying yes to kindness, yes to compassion, yes to allowing other beings to be free, yes to the beauty of life, yes to creativity and caring and kindness and respect to all life, and to really having a feeling for the preciousness of life and respecting the beauty of this earth and of the potential we have as human beings, and to live in a way where the ripples that radiate from my life into the world are to bless others. And I think we know at a deep level we're here to do that. We're here to bless the world. We're here to bring blessings to others, that our joy comes from that. We get no joy from getting something for myself that other people don't have. That breeds neurosis, fear, pain, suffering. We get our joy when we help others. We know this at a deep level. When we help others and we're serving others and we're making some kind of contribution that is authentic for us, then we are transforming ourselves and we feel a basic existential joy in our life. And that is our true heritage. We're forced to forget this because we live in a culture that makes money off people consuming. They want you to think if you consume the right things. But honestly, we know this. So veganism rides on this yes to life, and it is the most pro-life thing anyone can ever do. So if you have any comments or questions, I'm happy to address them for a little while here. And so fire away. Anyone have any questions? Yes.
I guess first I just want to say thanks for coming. I can't wait to read the book. But
thanks.
I keep getting this idea of scale. Like, it sounds like one of the chapters that you wrote talks about it, but in kind of like the killing in and of itself versus, you know, the attitude or mentality or the commoditization of it. I'm kind of like, I don't know if that makes sense as far as what I mean by scale, but I'll give some examples as far as like different ways it could be viewed differently. Like thinking of like my good grandmother talking to me about her farm 100 years ago and how that kind of was operated versus
okay.
And things like hunting white-tailed deer in southern Wisconsin, and then things like, you know, kind of, you know, where that line.
Well, I think, you know, there is a tendency for us to think that back in the good old days, it wasn't so bad what we did to animals, you know, because it was smaller scale, right? It wasn't this massive, you know, huge, like, assembly line, automatized, you know, devastating death camps for animals. It was all done in small local farms where they stabbed and killed them, you know. But I think it's important to remember that the reduction of these beings to things was still present. And, you know, back in the medieval period when they had geese, you know, running around, they didn't like them running around. They would nail their feet to the floor, you know. And they would do horrible things to animals, always. They did horrible things to animals. I mean, when you make them food, you do horrible things to them. It's happened. And I don't think we should romanticize it and think it was better before. It's always been brutal. If you're one of these animals, I mean, I think it's worse today. I will say it that. Because I think animals have gone basically from being basically wild, free, living their lives, to then at one point, 10,000 years ago, starting becoming herded. But then now it's like imprisoned in concentration camps. And then its next thing it's coming to even, it seems like, I mean, is being genetically engineered so that they even lose their biological integrity. They become just like unit, like totally, they, I don't know what they become. I mean, so we are reducing them more and more drastically. And they've become, and the wild animals are getting wiped out in incredible, I mean, you know, yeah, the scale, you're right. I mean, the scale. We're in the middle of the largest, as you know, extinction of species in 25 million years. So because of the devastation of habitat, primarily for eating animals. So I don't think, though, the answer is to go back to eating less animals. For one thing, there's too many of us to do that. Number two, that doesn't change the underlying mentality. So I think what it is to have an awakening that we don't need to eat animals. You know, we don't need to. I haven't eaten any animal foods in 27 years about. I haven't been to a doctor in 27 years. I mean, I guess that's bad for the medical establishment, but but it's the greatest thing, you know, for you know, health and longevity and mental clarity and all these other things, and creativity. It's just so I think so I think, you know, we shouldn't think that if we just, because there's quite a current about that right now. Well, if we could just go back to grass-fed and organic, then everything would be cool. Number one, you could never feed everybody that way. Number two, the mentality of brutality is still there. We're still going to brutalize each other. We're still, you know, having this mentality of reducing beings to things. That's really the essence of the problem. Anyone else have a, yes?
Yeah. You mentioned that the possibility of, like, our society sort of being converted into a vegan society. Possibility. I mean, realistically, like when I think of it, it sort of seems idealistic. I mean, there are so many people who are resistant to the idea, and I was wondering what your opinion was like. I mean, do you think that's a realistic, like, do you think realistically that our society would eventually?
It's almost like it wouldn't even be our society anymore. It'd be so different, you know. But I think it's like that would be the grandmother of all transformations. That would be the one that would just, you know, once we start letting animals live their lives and eat a plant-based diet and don't use them for experiment on them. Don't abuse them at all. Don't go, you know, looking at them. Don't have zoos and all this stuff. But I think it is possible. I mean, we are in an extremely turbulent time. We're at a time when there will be massive change within our lifetimes. Massive. I mean, one way or the other, there will be, I think, you know, and how that massive change is going to be. I have a subtitle of a chapter in there called The Last Days of Eating Animals. I think these are the last days of eating animals, one way or the other. We can't go on like this. So I personally, as Madeline and I travel around, I have to say, even though there's a lot of sort of, especially in the news, but remember, I call this thing the military-industrial meat-medical media complex. The military-industrial meat-medical media complex. It's very pervasive. And we get, I don't think we see the changes that are happening at the deeper roots. There's that old saying, remember from the 60s, the revolution will not be televised? It's really true. I think it's not going to be something, it's happening subterraneously, like, you know, here I am talking about it, and then you go talking about it to other people, and changes are going to be happening, and I think if a certain critical mass is reached, which maybe isn't that all that big, I mean, I'm not sure what the percentage is, it will really start going very fast. You know, there's been a lot of changes already. You know, you can go in, I mean, I just remember not that long ago, you couldn't get soy milk that was any good, you couldn't get, you know, now you can get all these things. People, you know, everyone knows what the word vegan means. That's incredible. You know, everyone knows it. Everyone knows what the word vegan means. You know, it's a word, it's out there, and so there's big, big changes. I think it could happen. Yeah, I do. Yes?
I've noticed that a lot of world religions, a lot of societies, they identify themselves with a lot of sacrificial behaviors and other things. But one thing I've looked through a lot of the world's religions is that they emphasize compassion, but there seems to be such a de-emphasis on compassion to animal life, not human life, or human life that is truly otherly. You know, so you hear this comment about doing unto others, but it's a very limited scope of what others. It's like, now, how do you? It's such an absurd manner of behaving. How do you account for this? Because this is the standard MO of world religions and most societies, especially ones that celebrate compassion and mercy.
All right. Well, I do talk about this in my book, in that chapter called Reductionist Science and Religion. And it's a good question. First of all, I have to say that it's the Jain religion, the Buddhist religion pretty much, and some other Eastern religions, Taoist and Hindu traditions, and I think even some of the shamanic traditions somewhat, do carry the ethic of kindness towards animals into their followers, into the people who are in that system. The more Western ones don't, but I think they do somewhat, actually. It's very interesting writings. I mean, I have quite a few quotes in here by famous Christians and Jewish and Muslim people saying, I can read some of them to you, but basically that kindness for animals is the essence of the religion. St. Francis saying, if you show me a man who harms an animal, I'll show you a man who will harm a human, and other, leaders talking about how important it is to have kindness and mercy for animals. So it is there, but you've got to remember, I think the basic thing is that any culture, a culture is like an organism. It tries to just reproduce itself. Whatever it is, it tries to reproduce itself. How does it reproduce itself? It reproduces itself by transmitting its practices and its values to the next generation. How does it do that? It does that through its institutions. What are the institutions? The institutions are religion, science, government, the family, law, and so forth. So the core of our culture is, the animals are things to be eaten. So there's no way you're going to have one of the institutions, like religion, saying, no, that's not true. then the culture would just like, you got to have a basic consistency, So that's why, for example, science and religion, I say they're not, because they're portrayed somehow in the media as like they're two opposites. You have science saying one thing, religion saying something else. What I believe is no. They are two sons of the herding culture. They basically propagate the herding culture's mentality in treatment of the animals, treatment of the earth, and they bicker. They're like bickering brothers. They bicker, they argue, but they're basically on the same side. And who they both attack viciously is Sophia. When Sophia starts saying, "Wait a minute, let's have kindness for animals," or "Wait a minute, let's look at this in another way," this feminine wisdom, they both, science and religion, both attack her. And so I think it's important to just understand that about religion. And then each one of us will, find our way. I think our challenge is to find our way to help transform our culture. And so each one of us will be drawn to work through one of the institutions. Maybe we'll work in education. Maybe we'll work in art, in the arts. Maybe we'll work in the religion. Maybe we'll work in science. Maybe we'll work in government. But somehow we can go and in government try to, change it, or in the media. We can work through our institutions. And we just have to, and I think, our religious institutions, you're right. I mean, they are not based on the teachings of the founders of the religion of compassion for all life. And they've been hijacked basically by the underlying mentality of the culture. So we should create new religions or recreate the ones we have to say what we think they should say, basically. So, anyone else? Yes.
Why did we choose 10,000 years ago or whatever to become this kind of?
How did we choose that?
Yeah, why
did it start? Yeah, that's always a good question. Yeah, how did it all get started? I think it was aliens that did. It's hard to say. I mean, I go into that in the book. But basically, what people, anthropologists are kind of, they're all arguing about this. No one really knows. I mean, we don't even know what happened on 9/11, right? We don't know what happened. How do we know what happened before history happened exactly? We just know we have anthropologists basically theorizing. They can have evidence that people started herding these animals around 10,000 years ago in this Kurdish region of Iraq, maybe they started doing it, you know, what they theorize is that they were hunters and they were hunting these wild sheep and wild goats, and then after, as the, you know, and it took a long time, as centuries and millennia went by, the tribes that were doing this started to think of the particular herd of sheep as like, that's our sheep, you know. And then with time, they were able to actually confine them, and then they started stealing the babies, killing the males, and blah, 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 and pretty soon they were actually messing with them and impregnating them and all that. So that's when they started hurting them. So, you know, I don't know, you know, exactly, but when they started doing it, they got it was like a change in the mentality of the people. They got more, they really started controlling nature in a different way. They really separated from nature, and they separated from the feminine, and then they got very bellicose and violent, and so then it just spread through conquering, you know, other cultures. So like once it happened one place, it just spread. And if you read about this, it's very interesting. I mean, it took thousands of years. It didn't happen overnight. It took centuries and centuries and centuries, and it happened very gradually. But you can read about when these cultures that were replaced. The cultures that were replaced had a lot. Some of them had metals. They didn't have. But they used them to make bowls. They didn't use them to make, you know, spears and things. And they worshipped feminine goddesses and so forth. And then these cultures came in over incursions that took, you know, again, hundreds and thousands of years, and conquered them and used the metals to make spears. And they had war gods, you know, like Zeus and all these, Enlil and Yahweh and sky gods. And they basically changed the culture. And then we ended up, we're in that culture today. So that's all best I can do, I guess. You know, it happened somehow. Yes?
Are you aware of the works of Daniel Quinn and Derek Johnson?
Yeah, you mean Ishmael and that's...
Yes. Yeah. They talk about some of the things that you talk about, and they link the beginning of our culture, dominant culture right now, to the agricultural revolution that occurred in Iraq.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they say that stockpile of food because the agricultural revolution caused the population to increase, so that culture could dominate all other cultures because they were able to fight with such a large population.
Right. Yeah, there might be some truth to that. I just don't think that it's... I mean, of course, you know, I guess we all interpret things in our own way. I don't think that he gives enough weight to what was really going on. I think growing food, especially if it's done in sustainable, small scale, is inherently, it's nurturing. You know, it's nurturing and caring for plants. It's very feminine work, but animal, you know, what we do to animals when you raise them is just the opposite. It's brutalization, it wasn't just agriculture. I think it was herding. I think it was herding of animals that really caused that change. That's what I think. Yes.
Could you comment on how to approach people talking about this kind of thing when you sense they're
okay,
so unwilling to?
Right. What I would say, as far as like approaching people with this, the best attitude I think to try to have, to plant seeds, and to not try to change anyone, because you know there's an old saying in some of the Eastern religions, don't be attached to the fruit of your actions, you know, because if I, you know, especially when we have people close to us, of course, it's kind of hard. And you know, going out with someone who loves to eat meat, and we want to change them. Come on, become a vegetarian. But the idea is, or family members, parents, or whoever. But I think the idea is to just plant seeds as skillfully as we can. And I don't think there's any sort of rule that will always apply to everyone. You know, I think every single interaction we have with another person is an individual, unique interaction. And so we have to use our intuition or our inner wisdom, our Sophia, our inner, you know, to tune into the situation and kind of feel like and make sure the person feels like you're listening to them. Because no one wants to be talked to by someone who knows more than they know in a way that they don't feel honored. You know, so it's important to kind of like listen to them and agree and not to argue with people. Because as soon as we start arguing with them, we've lost. All right, I think we've already lost. Unless there's a third person listening and you're trying to get them because you're arguing with them but you want them to hear, then it's good. But if you're with like a one-on-one, you start arguing, it's like probably not. So the best thing I think is to, you know, get people to feel like you sympathize and not to blame anyone, because people did not choose this on their own. People think that they chose it. No one in their own mind, you know, thought, oh, I think I'll have some milk, you know, like drinking milk, for example. I mean, no one had the idea when they saw a cow in the field, I think I'll go out there and kind of get under there and, you know, suck on. You know, it's not something that we do it because we have these whole industries in place that put it, you know, that stick it in our, right, in, you know, when we're little kids in school with a straw and that we have to drink it or we go to jail or something, you know. So if, so we're forced into it and we never chose it. And so it's important to realize that if someone has a belief, like most people do in our culture, that they need to eat meat and they want to eat meat, that's, that they did not arrive at freely on their own. It was forced onto them. They believe it, but they didn't. They don't know why they believe it. They just do. Then when you challenge that belief, they don't know what to say. They can't defend it because it's not something that... If you have a belief that you arrive at freely, and when someone challenges it, then you go, oh, that's interesting. Let's talk about it, you know, and it's kind of... It's great, you know. And, but if it's a, if I have a belief that I didn't arrive at freely, but I believe it because I was just, you know, injected into me, when someone challenges it, I would like change the subject or lash out or you know, some kind of thing just to stop it, stop this process. So if we can learn to plant seeds and then let go. And I think someone goes vegan, say, for example, it may there may be 50 interactions that led up to that. You know, 50 different people on the way, maybe they read an article somewhere, they saw a video somewhere, someone else said, well, no, I just don't eat animal foods. I don't want to contribute to cruelty. And they go, oh, really? You know, it's different things. And then maybe on the... They, after 49 times somewhere over many years, they get all these messages, and then on the 50th one comes, and they go, that's it. I'm not going to eat anymore. You know? And you might be the 50th one, and you think, oh, that was me. I did it. You know, it would never would have happened without those 49 other people. So those 49 other people might think, oh, I didn't. It failed. I didn't get them to change. Just don't worry. Just plant the seed, and other people will, and don't be attached to it. And the other thing, I think, is to understand that... being a vegan is not just sort of this like behavior. It's not just behavior. It's not just not eating animal foods and wearing them and so forth. It really means having a mentality of kindness for all life and really not excluding any being from the sphere of my compassion. So it is actually an ongoing psychological or spiritual path of purification and greater awakening. And I think the more we progress, you know, on this path, the more when we speak to people, our words will have weight. People will just feel it. We're more intuitive than we think. We're more telepathic than we think. So, if someone says to me, "Oh, I tell people to go vegan, but they just don't listen to me," it's probably because it hasn't gotten deep into them yet. Because if we go around and start judging people, start putting people down, then we are not, that's not vegan action. I mean, vegan action is understanding and holding everyone within the circle of our compassion. So when we really start to live this way, we'll find that people will start to listen. Our words will have weight and will be effective, much more effective. So I think our inner, you know, Gandhi said it great. Gandhi, he was so brilliant. He said, social change cannot happen without personal change. So the personal change is becoming a vegan in this outer sense of behavior, which is very important. But beyond that, to really integrate it at a deeper and deeper level, and I think it's a never-ending process potentially of growing to the point when we just love everybody at a deep level. And I think we can reach far more people the more we all do that. Yes? Laboratory grown meat is kind of interesting, you know. It's there's this idea that we can have this lab grown meat, and that will free us from killing animals for food for the meat. So it seems on the surface that it's a good idea, and I guess it is a good idea on the surface, but it just seems so absurd because we already have tempeh, we already have these wonderful things that, you know, and it doesn't somehow it's like it doesn't change the consciousness of the people. You know, I mean, I don't know if they would still do experimentation on animals, still abuse animals, but maybe a little. It will allow for people to begin to open because they won't be eating the animal foods. So, I see it as a possibly good thing. You know, that science maybe will get to the point where we don't have to kill all these animals for food. But I just wonder. I personally think it seems a lot more empowering if we just choose to say, I'm not going to do that, you know, rather than just eating animal, because that's what, you know, animal flesh that doesn't come from animals, if that is in fact even possible. I guess we'll find out. Anyone else have any questions? Or yes? Okay, yeah.
You mentioned this notion of cultural shadow.
Cultural shadow.
Cultural shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And relate that to work. Right? It's a chapter to work.
Yeah.
But could you elaborate more on that shadow?
Okay, I'll do that. Okay. Basically, the idea of the shadow is that shadow is what the person is, but we're not that, but we really are. Okay. For example, and a culture does the same thing. You know, we're good, kind, upright, loving people, and we just like having a good steak. You know, that's the kind of thing. So we have this, and so what that does is the mentality that underlies that is invisible, of violence. And so what we'll then do, what the shadow does is then it does two things. It numbs us, and we have to just like sort of disconnect from all those parts of ourselves that are that way, so we just don't feel that or don't admit to that. And then the other thing is we project the shadow. So then we will find people out there who have those qualities that we actually have, but we deny having, so we will then project them. We'll see them in them, and we'll say, there's people over there, and they're vicious, and they're terrorists, and they harm in a cruel way, and we're going to build some weapons, and we're going to attack them, because they're going to come and get us. And so this is the projection of the shadow, and it always happens. And the funny thing is, what Carl Jung said was, the bigger the shadow is, the harder it is to see. Which seems amazing, but it's true. If it's just a little shadow, you know, like in my own life, I can see that. If it's a little thing, I can kind of catch it, go, ooh, that's a part of myself I don't think I am, but I actually really am. And then I can work with it and heal it. But if it's a really big shadow, it's like, it doesn't even exist. You know, we don't even see it. And so it's so funny, you can have people, these Jungian scholars, writing about the shadow, and all, they're eating meat, they don't even know about this, the biggest one. And I think until we are able to actually work with this, this is the last big shadow, I think, is what we do to animals for food. It's huge. It's so much part of us, our daily life, our food, all our gatherings are around food, everything. Until we address this one, I don't think we'll be successful in dealing with any of our shadows. And the final thing I'll just say maybe about that is that I think for us, if we say have began to face this and work with this, and we've say gone vegan, that there's a tendency, I think, for us to feel bitter. There may be a tendency, anyway, to feel bitter and to feel, kind of like depressed about our culture, or to feel angry about the whole way our culture is. And I want to just encourage everyone, if you are vegan or if you're almost there or going there, to try not to fall into that trap, because it's easy to happen. You know, the average person who's eating meat, which is like, you know, most of the people, drive down the street and they see our culture, and they really don't have any reason to be upset about it, seeing McDonald's and Burger King and Arby's and Wendy's and Kentucky Chicken and, well, I don't know, whatever, the junk in the box, all these different things. They think, oh, this looks great, this is wonderful, and delicious food everywhere, and let's have some of this, have some of that. And if we're, as vegans, we drive down the same street, it's just the opposite. You know, we see, oh, McDonald's, oh, they're killing all these, and then, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken, all. And so we, you know, we go home, and after just driving around town, we just feel like, gosh, there's so much violence, and no one sees it. You know, it's just this culture, man, it sucks. I hate this place, you know. And then someone comes along and says, so you're a vegan, huh? And you go, yeah, man, I hate this culture. It really sucks, you know what I mean? And so they think, well, if you're a vegan, I don't want to be a vegan. So I think it's important to consciously try to see the beauty around us, and to see especially the beauty in nature, and to adopt a positive attitude about our life, because I think really if we really have made the commitment to animals and have gone vegan, then we are entitled to feel some joy, and it really is there. So even though we're aware, and it's the funniest thing, I think, you know, these horrible videos that I've seen so many of what they do to animals on factory farms, The great irony is the only one that ever watches, the only ones that ever watch those videos are vegans, you know, because they'll never get a meat eater to look at those. They go, oh, I'm not going to look at that. Oh, yeah, I'm not going to look at that. You know? So we go through, we look at all this, we go, oh, man, you know, you should really see this. You know, you ought to go and see it. You're the one that they don't want to see it. So we see all this, we're aware of all this horror, we see it everywhere, you know, so there's a tendency of us for us to be, you know, it's understandable to be depressed, miserable, upset, you know, but it's important, I think, then to counterbalance that with seeing the beauty of the birds and the trees and the flowers and the children and whoever, you know, however we can to connect and be grateful for the opportunity that we have to be creative and to make a change, to make a positive change. There are lots of seeds of light and hope and justice and kindness in the world. They're not emphasized by the media, but we can see them if we start to, and if we don't see them, then create them. You know, we can create them, and I think by doing that, we can connect at a deeper level. Remember what Cahil Gibran said? He said, until you weep all of your tears, you will never laugh all of your laughter. You know, most people are kind of caught in this shallow level where they don't really feel anything. You know, they don't feel the pain. They don't feel the joy. They're really kind of numb. And going vegan is kind of like feeling again. You start to feel and start to cry and start to go, wow, and then start to feel joy, you know, real great joy too. And so it's just coming alive. It's like getting alive again. And then whole new life, new creativity, everything changes. And it's the best thing. It really does. It's just it's almost like, you know, people, oh, I don't know how to say it. It's like people who are eating animal foods, it's like they have shoes on that are so tight, but they're so used to them, they think, they just feel good to me. You know, I like how they are, you know. And you say, try taking off these shoes and put on, you know. And then once someone does it, and they say, wow, it's like, I think most people have on some level this subterranean despair and fear and panic and nightmares and all kinds of things from what they're eating. We really know. And right now there's a huge problem, especially with women, but men too, with depression. I mean, the biggest selling drugs in this culture are for depression. So many people are depressed. And what are we eating? We're eating depression, you know. So to be free from this is such a great blessing. You'll feel better and better and better, I guarantee. Just but focus on the positive. It's really important. Okay, one last one. Go ahead.
Comment on the use of meditation for what you're just talking about.
What was that?
Use of meditation,
right. I think it's very helpful to meditate. We have one CD here, which is a guided meditation on the four viharas. Vihara is an old Sanskrit word that means home. The four viharas are the four aspects of our true home, which are love, compassion, joy, and peace. So meditating on love, compassion, joy, and peace, learning to quiet our mind, come into the present moment, these are all very helpful things to do. And radiate love, compassion, joy, and peace. It comes back. You'll feel better and better, and can help create a world. I think we create a world of joy and peace by being joyful and peaceful. You know, that's how it happens. All right, so, last of the last question.
There's been much debate about this, but scientists and studies show that genes have as much of an effect on how we behave and think as environment does. So wouldn't it also take maybe a genetic revolution as well as a cultural revolution to change how not only how we act toward animals but toward each other? Because there might be something else inherent in how we behave.
I really think that, thanks for your question, I really think we've basically been sold a bill of goods about genes. I don't think that we're genetically driven. See, it is to the profit of the military-industrial, medical, media complex to make us think that it's in our genes. Because if it's in our genes, we have no control over it. And they have us right where they want us, in the palm of their hands. Then you have no control. Take our drugs, you know, and you'll just be happy because we can sort of solve it for you. We have power. I mean, biologists are discovering that whatever genes we have are affected by our attitudes, our emotions, our beliefs, our actions, and we're brainwashed into thinking that genes have this power over us. This guy Bruce Lipton, this biologist, I just listened to this tape. He's talking very much how genes are merely a blueprint, and what we do with that blueprint is up to us. We can change ourselves. And I just think we shouldn't believe this part. It's being forced down our throats everywhere you read. It's genes, genes, genes. And it's disempowering. It's totally disempowering. The idea is that, well, you know, What are we going to do? It's just in the genes. You know, it's in the genes to be violent, or it's in the genes to be sick, or it's, you know. I love this one. Well, this disease, it runs in the family. You know, it just runs in the family. Why does it run in the family? Because everybody in the family has this, their legs under the same dinner table. That's why it runs in the family. You know, it's this. It's, they're all eating the same thing. That's why it runs in the family. So we can change our behavior. I don't think it's genetic. I really don't. All right, so thank you all for joining us. I hope that our paths cross again. I'm happy to answer questions individually for a little while, sign books, CDs, whatever, cards. Keep up the great work. Thank you so much, people of Mars, for the work you're doing. And really, never doubt that any seed you plant is lost, you know, or that any effort that you make to raise your consciousness, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to be a voice for the children. I mean, there's so much more I didn't talk about today that I should have, like starvation and hunger and all these other things. But it's all in the book. But the work that we're doing is the most important work. I think there's nothing more vital and more like of the core of this than to actually question our treatment of animals for food. That's really the seed of bringing peace to our planet. So thanks for the efforts you're making, and never doubt that any effort is lost. And really, we can do this together. Bless you all. I love you so much. Thanks for coming, and thank you again. Thanks.